Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Christina Maruzic is an award-winning journalist who covers environmental health and justice for Environmental Health News. Her new book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes, Revolutionizing Prevention. In searching for information on cancer prevention, Maruzic met remarkable doctors, scientists, and advocates who are upending our understanding of cancer and how to fight it. They recognize that we will never reduce cancer rates without ridding our lives of the chemicals that increasingly trigger the deadly disease. The new book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes, Revolutionizing Prevention. And we welcome Christina Maruzic to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. That idea of revolutionizing prevention, what brought you to want to look into that?
My younger sister was diagnosed with thyroid cancer when she was 25 years old, which is very young for a cancer diagnosis. And thyroid cancer typically runs in families, but no one else in our family had ever had thyroid cancer before or since. And so my family was really left wondering if something my sister was exposed to might have played a role in her cancer. And I'm also an investigative reporter, as you mentioned. So thinking about some of those questions, I wrote a five-part series for Environmental Health News a few years ago that looked at higher than national average rates of certain types of cancer in Pennsylvania, where my sister and I grew up, and ties to environmental exposures and specifically air pollution. And while I was reporting that series, I learned a couple of things about environmental exposures and cancer that were really shocking to me. And I wanted to look into those more, which is what led me to the book.
When you started with the original project, what were the surprises along the way for you as you investigated of what you found when it comes to prevention and what possibilities there are?
I was really surprised to learn that up to 95% of cancer cases are the result of preventable environmental exposures. So certainly genetics play a role in our susceptibility to cancer, but there are very few cancer cases that are entirely caused by genetics. So most cancers happen because of a combination of our genetic susceptibility and then the exposures we get throughout our lives. I was also really surprised to learn that over the last 50 years since we started tracking global cancer rates, we've seen a really steep and consistent increase in rates of certain types of cancers associated with environmental exposures, including childhood cancer and cancer in young adults like my sister. And while I was working on that series on cancer in the environment, I spoke with a really smart researcher who's also a pediatrician and an epidemiologist named Dr. Phil Landrigan. And he pointed out that these increases in cancer rates are happening way too fast to be caused by genetic changes, because those happen over centuries and not decades. And they also can't be entirely explained by better diagnostic tools. So the kind of basic tools that doctors use to diagnose childhood cancer are generally the same now as they were back in the 1970s. So it's also not a matter of just diagnosing more of something that's always been there. And he said the only other option is something in the environment, which was, I think, was really surprising to me. I think that's kind of runs contrary to the way we tend to think about cancer and cancer risk.
Well, right. And you make that point throughout the book that we fight cancer, but we don't always fight for finding what is actually causing it and how we can prevent it. Why do you think that is, and are there positive signs in your opinion that is changing?
So there are two main reasons for why the war on cancer so far has mostly focused on treatment and not prevention. And that definitely is true. So right now, only about 7 to 9% of all global funding for cancer goes toward prevention. And the main reason is that there are huge market incentives for treatment. The global oncology market is valued at about $330 billion right now, and it's projected to grow to about $580 billion by 2050. But there's no similar market projection for cancer prevention, unfortunately. So a drive for prevention is going to have to come from places other than the marketplace, namely laws and regulations. The other reason is that it's much harder to advocate for prevention. So when you're advocating for a cure or for treatments for cancer, you can put the face of a mom or a little kid who has cancer on the poster and the t-shirts and the Facebook pages. And it's really easy to get people to feel empathy and want to join the fight and do whatever they can to help them out. But when we talk about prevention, it ends up being really data heavy. So it's a lot of statistics about long-term trends and cancer rates. And it's the nature of prevention that we don't get to know whose cancer we prevented. So we don't get to meet the person whose life we saved or get hugs from the family we spared the heartache of going through a childhood cancer diagnosis. So that's part of what I wanted to do with the book. There are lots of statistics in the book, certainly, but it's really focused on the stories of people who've dedicated their lives to cancer prevention. So I wanted to try and tell the human stories that are behind this movement.
The stories are fascinating. And there's some people that I would like to focus on. One is Melanie Mead. And give us a sense of her story and how you came to it.
Melanie Mead is a clean air advocate in Clairton, Pennsylvania, where she lives beside a really heavily polluting industrial site. Called the Clairton Coke Works, that's run by U.S. Steel. And that's about 20 miles south of Pittsburgh, where I live. So I met Melanie when I was reporting on air quality in the Pittsburgh region. And Clairton, where Melanie lives, often has some of the dirtiest air in the country because that plant is the biggest site in the country for making coke, which is an ingredient used in steel making. And that's a super dirty operation. They have to heat coal to extremely high temperatures to create coke, and the emissions from this plant are really carcinogenic. The plant is also extremely old, and the pollution controls aren't up to date, so they have a lot of problems with violating clean air laws. They're kind of constantly getting sued and fined for breaking laws. And Melanie's story is really heartbreaking. She grew up there, and in like an 8-year period, every member of her immediate family died of either cancer or respiratory disease or heart disease. And so she lost both of her parents and 3 siblings. And she started learning about, the health effects of emissions from this plant and became really engaged with activism in the region. And so I met her when she was speaking out at a press conference, telling people, what had happened to her family and demanding cleaner air in the community. And I think her story is really moving because despite all that she's gone through, she sticks around, she stays, and she keeps fighting for the community. And I know that, there are people like Melanie Mead who are fighting for their communities all across the country and all over the world who are up against huge corporations and facing really difficult odds. But they stay and keep fighting.
When you talk about prevention, a lot of this comes to town boards and so forth, where a plant is being proposed or something is going to be some mining, or whether it be a coke plant or something else, or that there are concerns about the operations of a plant that has already been built. It's not all industrial, but I'm just using it as an example. It seems my take on this is as a cynical reporter is that often, as I sit in these meetings and people come with cancer mapping studies and great concerns and anecdotal stories, that those are very easily put aside and passed over. I'm curious as to why that's the case, because it seems like compelling evidence, like, oh, by the way, this may kill you, would sort of stop people in their tracks and say, oh, maybe we should look at this further, but also of why it is put aside and what the impetus is and how people can continue to try to fight.
That's a great question and certainly a big question. One thing that's difficult is that we still don't have the ability generally to trace one specific person's cancer to one specific environmental exposure, one or more environmental exposures. That happens really rarely, usually in like an occupational setting. If someone's exposed to cancer-causing substances every day at their job for 30 years, that's easier to do. And so the evidence generally is this kind of population level evidence. Hey, when these plants go in a community, we end up seeing a lot more cancer 20 or 30 years later. And that time lag also poses a difficulty, right? Because it's not cancer takes a long time to develop. So it's often not an immediate effect, which I think makes it harder to pressure regulators and lawmakers to act in this kind of quick way. Another thing that I've encountered a lot reporting on this issue in Pennsylvania is that most state regulatory agencies don't have a mechanism for denying permits when a company applies to build a plant like this. The only mechanism they have is, are based on like incomplete permit applications, or occasionally if they have if there is wildlife in the area with specific protections. But in Pennsylvania, for example, there's no way for the state State Department of Environmental Protection that's responsible for handing out these permits to say, hey, this is an environmental justice community, and actually there are tons of other polluting facilities there. We're already seeing higher rates of cancer and asthma and respiratory disease, so we're going to deny this permit. There's nothing in the law that allows them to do that, even when that's the case, which I know can be frustrating for regulators too, because sometimes it's really plain to see that a community is already really overburdened by pollution. So we have a lot of legwork to do to make our regulatory systems more friendly to communities and humans that live there than they are to corporations that apply for permits.
The idea of prevention, of course, and prevention can come in so many ways. What then can someone do? What do we know about what someone can do if they are in a situation or they are at a place or they have concerns about an area that they're in of what they personally can do about that? Because it seems limited.
Yeah, so one of the things I heard again and again working on my book from the people who work on this issue all day, every day is that this problem is too big for us to shop our way out of as individual consumers. So certainly there are ways to think about the chemicals that are in the food that you eat and the water that you drink and in the air pollution you're exposed to. And there are some steps we can take at the individual level that can help reduce our individual exposures. But even if you have a PhD in chemistry and you are working on this issue all day, every day, these chemicals are just so ubiquitous that it's still not possible to entirely avoid them by, reading every label and becoming a really mindful consumer. So I'm happy to share some of those tips because I know this subject can be a little scary and overwhelming for folks, and it certainly can make us feel better to do some of those things we can do on an individual level. But I do want to emphasize that, what we really need is systemic change that will protect all of us much more broadly. And there are other places in the world that do a better job of this already than we do. So the way the European Union regulates harmful chemicals isn't perfect, but they have more of a precautionary approach, which means that companies that want to put new chemicals into the marketplace are responsible for proving that they're safe over the long term for people to be exposed to. And here we kind of do the opposite thing, where generally companies can do whatever they want. And then 20 years later, if a bunch of people got cancer, they end up having to file a class action lawsuit. And we're seeing those increasingly where, the people filing those lawsuits are winning. So we've seen a lot of PFAS lawsuits recently, Johnson & Johnson baby powder, asbestos. And anyone who's involved in those lawsuits will tell you, if they lost a loved one to cancer, or they lost years of their lives undergoing treatment, they would have rather had a precautionary approach where, the company was responsible for proving that this was safe instead of people in the community being responsible for proving that harmful chemicals, caused them to get sick. So we really need to push toward better regulations of these substances in this country. But in the meantime, there are some things we can do to protect ourselves as individuals. That includes things like eating organic when you can to avoid pesticides, using an air filter in your house. A HEPA filter is best. Buying safer cosmetics and personal care products. And there are some apps and websites that can help you avoid potentially harmful ingredients in those products. And then things like safer building renovations, and the Healthy Building Network has lots of resources on choosing less toxic building materials. So those are a couple of quick little things. And I do share some more of those in the book, but the book is really focused on, people who are pushing toward these bigger picture solutions and how we can get involved and help with that.
And also introducing us, as we mentioned earlier, to some amazing people and their work and what they have done. The book is endlessly fascinating and hopeful, right? It seems hopeful.
Yeah, I think, I mentioned this topic can be kind of overwhelming for people. I think, generally when people start learning that they've been kind of constantly exposed to low doses of cancer-causing chemicals their whole lives without their permission or awareness, people tend to fall into two camps. One is either become like a really obsessive consumer and decide you're going to read every label and shop really carefully and do everything you can to protect yourself and your family. And the other is to be like, well, everything gives you cancer anyway, so I'm just not going to think about this anymore because it's too upsetting. And I found when I was reporting on this that I felt both of those impulses. But then as I met these people who've devoted their lives to this work, and I learned about their stories and why they're involved and heard how passionate they are, and also heard about all the wins that they've had, all the successes they've had over the years, and how this kind of happened, behind the scenes, that I didn't even know these people were, fighting for my health and that they've had these really impressive victories, it made me feel hopeful. It made me feel hopeful, and it made me want to get involved and help out. And so I hope that the book will do that for readers, too.
The name of the book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. The book is published by Island Press. Christina Marozic, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. It's really been great talking to you.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Again, the name of the book is A New War on Cancer, The Unlikely Heroes Revolutionizing Prevention. The book is published by Island Press. Christina Marozic is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.